This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about the 19th century physician John Snow and his contributions to medicine. But first, we look back in time. And I mean, we're going way back, set that way back machine to 200 million years, and get a glimpse of an ancient sea creature dubbed Terrible-Headed Lizard from the Orient. It's not like anything alive today, and the fossil find has helped scientists solve a long-standing mystery of how animals like these caught their prey. The scientists from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the Field Museum, and the University of Chicago report their research in today's issue of the journal Science. And one of the researchers joins us today to talk about this interesting sea creature. And if you'd like to join our discussion, 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And if you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, go over to sciencefriday.com, you'll see a photo of this creature so you get an idea of what we're talking about. Let me introduce my guest. Michael LaBarbera is a professor in the Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy, the Department of Geophysics Sciences, and he's on the Committee on Evolutionary Biology at the University of Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Ira.
What makes this creature so unusual? Describe him for us.
Well, let's start with the body. Imagine an egg, a little bit squashed, that's about 3 feet long. And on the front end of that, stick a neck that's about 5 feet long and about 3 inches in diameter. On the end of that, put a head that's about 5 inches long. It's a very elongated head and neck relative to the size of the body. On the back end, there would have been a tail too, but we don't know how big that was because it's not on this fossil.
So it's the neck that's the most striking feature of this creature.
Right.
It's like sort of like a giraffe neck.
I think even more extreme than a giraffe.
Even more extreme.
It's certainly more slender and longer in proportion to the size of the body. And, of course, this animal has flippers, not legs.
Is this the first time anybody's ever found a fossil of this creature?
Of this particular one, yes. We've found fossils of its relatives, but its relatives were semi-aquatic, amphibious. This is the only member of the group called the Protorosaurs that was fully aquatic.
What's the name of this that you've given it in its real name?
Are you ready? Okay, take a deep breath. It's Dinocephalosaurus.
I could say that, Dinocephalosaurus. Even I have trouble with names. Or you could give it that English version, right? The terrible-headed lizard from the Orient?
I find Dinocephalosaurus easier to remember.
So you're not going to see this in any museum anywhere that you go now?
Not yet. The fossil is in China. It hasn't left China yet. There is only one fossil of the complete skeleton. Mm-hmm. And right now it's staying in China, so it can continue to be studied.
All right. So we see this dinosaur has a very long neck. That means it must do something with that neck, right?
Oops. I got to stop you right there. Be careful. It's not a dinosaur.
Oh, it's not a dinosaur.
It looks like a dinosaur.
Oh.
And it's got dino in its name.
Uh-huh.
But no, it's a fossil reptile.
This is even more intriguing.
Okay. It's easy to misunderstand and think that all of these Mesozoic, bizarre, reptilian beasts are all dinosaurs, but they're not. Much of the really interesting diversity is not a member of the group we know as the dinosaurs, but other reptilian groups. So the flying animals, the pterodactyls, those aren't dinosaurs.
Right.
They're a reptilian group. They're related to the dinosaurs, but they're not dinosaurs. Plesiosaurs and pliosaurs and Dimetrodon and all the other plastic things that you played with when you were a kid, those aren't dinosaurs. Those are really reptiles. And so is this. This is a reptile, a marine reptile.
I stand well corrected, and thank you for that.
Let's
talk about this reptile with the long neck. And that was one of the mysteries of what this neck was all about, right, when you found it?
Well, yeah. We've seen other marine reptiles that had long necks, and we thought we knew what long necks were for in these animals.
Yeah.
They've always been reconstructed as being part of the prey capture, that the animal would have an elongate neck like a plesiosaur, for example, and it would dart the head out like a snake striking and grab a fish out of the water. And that all made perfect sense because the animals had lots of vertebrae and had a very flexible neck. This animal was important in that it told us that we needed to go back and think again about that explanation, because here was an animal with an extremely elongated neck, but the neck clearly was not flexible, was quite stiff.
Yeah.
And the reason it was stiff was it was reinforced by cervical ribs attached to the neck vertebrae that were actually longer than the vertebrae, so they overlapped each other. So here we have this mystery of an animal with a long neck, but the neck clearly wasn't snaking out and grabbing fish. So the importance of long necks must have to do with something other than prey capture directly. Mm-hmm. Thinking about this, I think I had an advantage here because I actually do a lot of my research is on marine invertebrates, right. And so I spend a lot of time in the water. And I can remember more than one occasion in which I stare off into the gloom and something comes out of the gloom at me, and it's within a couple of meters before I can figure out what the heck it is. And I started to think about what would this animal have looked like if it was swimming not in those pristine, crystal clear waters that you always see in paintings and museums, but in a real ocean that's dirty and turbid, mm-hmm. And the visibility is bad. And the answer is, if you were a fish in the Triassic and you looked out into the gloom, you'd see a little dark speck approaching, and it would be about your size. And I don't know what the fish would think, but probably questions would arise of either mating or eating. And as the thing got closer, it was only when it was in a couple of meters that you would see that behind it was something much bigger, and it was attached, and this was not a fish. It was rather the head of an animal, at which point it would have slurped you up.
And that seems the interesting part is that it's not going to bite you, it's going to vacuum you up, right?
That's the other piece of this. Yeah. Like I said, I think what we need to do is divorce the idea of long necks from the method of prey capture. Mm-hmm. So plesiosaurs and pliosaurs, plesiosaurs and Denicephalosaurus both had long necks, and it probably functioned as a sort of camouflage, a way of deceiving the prey into thinking they weren't as big as they really were until it was too late. Right. But the actual way that they capture the prey is very different, that the plesiosaurs would snake their head out and grab the fish. These animals took those cervical ribs attached to the neck vertebrae, and they were very long. They had muscles attached at one end and could splay them out to the sides, stretching the throat, increasing the diameter of the esophagus, and in the process sucking in seawater, a large quantity of seawater. This is a mode of feeding called suction feeding, and it's actually quite common among aquatic animals today. Fish and some reptiles and lots of amphibians use this mode of feeding, but all of those animals expand the mouth in order to suck the seawater in. This animal would have expanded the throat, and it would have created a much bigger suction than is known among any of the living animals.
And is this because he didn't have that flexible neck? He had to find some other way of capturing the fish or something?
If you're going to expand the throat and you're going to use ribs to make that throat flare out, you can't have a flexible neck also, so that you have to choose one or the other.
Yeah, and nature selected which one?
I'm not sure nature selected which one, but rather that this animal followed a route that made it more likely to choose one mode of prey capture over another, partly because it comes from a group that tended to have fairly elongate cervical ribs to start with.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, 1-800-989-TALK. Which group was that?
It's called the Protorosaurus. You've never heard of them. They're fairly obscure. Only real vertebrate paleo nuts know very much about them. My friends love them. They think they're wonderful. But to tell you the truth, I had never heard of them before my colleague Olivier Rappel dropped the picture of this thing on my desk.
Huh. So you think there are a lot more of this whole class, class not being the right word to use, but I'll use it anyhow, of sea creatures that it might be out there that we could discover the fossils?
Well, it's possible that there are other fully aquatic relatives, but I don't think we're going to find a huge diversity of these animals. Mm-hmm. The group as a whole was moderately diverse, but most of its members were semi-aquatic, were not fully aquatic. And none of the other members were doing anything like the suction feeding that we propose for this animal.
Hmm. And so how close do you think this animal had to get to its prey, and how big its prey could it suck in?
Well, I think the size of the prey was mostly limited by how wide it could spread its mouth. Reptiles are pretty good at stretching their throats out. Even living reptiles, of course, don't chew their food. They don't have the teeth to do that, so they have to swallow their prey whole. So it's simply a matter of whatever will fit through the back of the jaws will go down the throat. My guess is that we're dealing with animals that would be eating squid, decent-sized fish on the order of, say, a foot long, nothing bigger than that. So although if you ran into it in the oceans, it would probably scare you, it probably also couldn't eat you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if this was a reptile, should we assume it's an air-breathing animal?
Oh, it most definitely was air breathing. Yeah. Every
so
time
it came up and down, you know, I'm thinking of a Loch Ness monster sort of thing.
Well, it came up and down, but not quite in the way that the Loch Ness monster has been pictured.
Yeah.
For one thing, this animal didn't have protuberances on the top of its neck vertebrae where muscles could attach. So it certainly couldn't raise its head up with any strength at all. We know that it didn't simply stick its head out of the water and keep the body 6 feet down because it could never inhale against the water pressure. So it must have been at the air-water interface, right at the surface when it was breathing, and the neck would have been held horizontally. It would have been swimming with the neck parallel to the surface, which would have done two things for the animal. One, it would be a lot easier than trying to hold your neck out.
Right.
And secondly, there's kind of an obscure problem that arises for things that travel on the surface of water, and that is they all generate wakes. In front of the animal, there's a bow wave. In the back, there's a trough, just like any boat that you've ever been in. And that wave that's attached to the boat or the animal has a natural speed that it moves across the water. That speed is proportional to the length of the wave, so that the longer the boat, the faster the wave goes. The faster the boat can go before it starts to actually climb up its own bow wave. The same is true of animals. So if you've ever watched a duck swim, for example, a duck has a pretty sedate pace, and that's the natural speed at which the wave that it's generating propagates at. So if you try to get a duck to go fast, A, they don't like to do it, and you can tell that they have to work really hard to do it. If this animal used its whole neck stretched out along the surface of the water, it would have made a hull, in essence, that was much longer, and therefore the animal could have moved and swum much faster while breathing than it could have otherwise.
Hmm. So what happened to all these animals with these long necks like these? How come we don't see them around today?
Well, there's two answers to your question. One is these animals certainly died out. We don't know of any progeny of these particular forms. And indeed, we don't even know how long this form lived since we only have two fossils and they're both from one location in China. Later on in the Mesozoic, another long neck group evolves, the plesiosaurs, and separately yet another group, the elasmosaurs, both with extremely elongate necks and small heads. So my suspicion is they're using the same stealth and deception tactic that the other animals did. But when all of the large reptiles go extinct at the end of the Cretaceous, mammals take over the world. This is something that we're all moderately grateful for. And when they go back to the ocean, there's a problem that they face in terms of the diversification into these niches. You see, all mammals are limited to having 7 cervical vertebrae, 7 neck vertebrae. Mm-hmm. And so if you were going to make a long-necked animal, all you could do is make 7 very long vertebrae. You couldn't put in a lot of vertebrae and make even a moderately flexible neck. In essence, if you wanted to be a long-necked animal in the oceans, you'd have to be a giraffe. Giraffes have extremely stiff necks. For mammals, it probably makes more sense to simply ignore that particular option, the deception option, and use the fact that mammals have a high metabolic rate, can swim extremely rapidly, have the ability to generate high amounts of power in a short amount of time, and chase their prey down, out-accelerate it and outrun it. And so you get the body shapes like dolphins and whales that are convergent, incidentally, on the same shapes that we see in, for example, ichthyosaurs that probably use the same tactics.
Yeah, fascinating. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, yeah, and happy hunting.
Okay.
Go looking for more of these. Michael LaBarbera is professor in the Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy and the Department of Geophysical Sciences, and he's on the Committee on Evolutionary Biology at the University of Chicago in Illinois. We're going to take a short break, come back, and switch gears and talk about a very famous incident that happened 150 years ago and made Dr. John Snow very famous and changed the course of medicine. Stay with us. We'll be right back.